Today is August the 4th, 2021. Back on August the 4th, 1983, was the first broadcast of the Personal Computer Show. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key, and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, that's the Progressive Radio Network, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.FM on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. "5G has been hyped as the greatest thing since sliced bread." The common phrase, "the best thing since sliced bread," as a way of hyping a new product or invention, may have come into use based on an advertising slogan for Wonder Bread, the first commercial manufacturer of pre-wrapped and pre-sliced bread. Well, I'm not much of a bread eater, but I'm more of a rice eater, but this may be apropos. The first 5G networks didn't come online until April of last year, and 5G phones didn't start shipping until later in the spring. The few 5G-ready devices that appeared initially were prohibitively expensive. So the question in 2019 wasn't, should I get a 5G phone, but rather, why would you want to? Things have definitely changed over the last 12 months. All four major U.S. carriers now offer 5G coverage, though how extensive that service is varies from carrier to carrier. 5G phones are still among the most expensive phones you can buy today, but you'll find a few that cost less than $1,000. A big change from 2019, when four-figure prices were standard for 5G models. So the question of whether you should now get a 5G phone is more relevant in 2021. As for the answer, it still depends on where you live, which wireless carrier you use, and how much you're ready to spend for a phone. In a survey by Android Authority Portal, the results of 5G acceptance was a surprise. Although the number of smartphones with fifth-generation connectivity is growing rapidly, the technology is not as popular as one might expect. Many people have enough Wi-Fi connection during the day, some have enough 4G LTE, while others are simply not satisfied with the quality of the new type of connections. It turned out that about 40% of users turn off their 5G altogether. The study, conducted by the popular Android Authority Portal, involved more than 1,300 respondents. Additionally, survey participants were encouraged to share their comments. As it turned out, 5G is always active only in 50.11% of respondents. The organizers did not rule out that some just do not yet know how to disable this very energy-consuming function. Remarkably, there is really a large number of users who have 5G always off. Their share was 39.4%, and they use smartphones without activating the new function in any circumstances. It is assumed that such users do not see the real benefits of 5G or the quality of communications of the next generation in the region where they live, while it leaves much to be desired. Finally, 10.51% of respondents turn off 5G in cases where the corresponding signal is weak or the battery of the smartphone is almost empty. It is noteworthy that the poor signal quality was noted by many commentators. Obviously, the technology has not yet reached a sufficient level of development. I never turn off 4G. My Pixel 5 does it for me. Or, if you're driving, walking, or entering a building, don't even think about turning on 5G, as LTE will be faster. I turn off 5G on my iPhone to conserve battery power, some say, and these are the common comments. In addition, some users indicate that in tests, 5G demonstrates high performance, and in real conditions, it's much slower than LTE when using 4G. Pages load faster, YouTube does not require content buffering, etc. At the same time, users indicate that they are in areas saturated with 5G towers, and in theory, the connection should be excellent. It's worth noting that the portal did not adhere to any strict standards of the survey, and everyone could participate in it without confirming the specified data. You know, most people don't realize that with the higher frequency, the shorter the distance. With the shorter the distance, well, the coverage may not reach a larger distance, and therefore the weaker the signal. The weaker the signal, the more drain on the battery. So if you like 5G, it is the greatest thing since sliced bread. But for at least 40% of the people and probably more, it's not sliced bread. Dell cannot ship Alienware PCs to certain U.S. states due to power regulations. High-end PC sales excluded in certain states. Sometimes the fight for energy efficiency and low power consumption goes off the rails. High-performance desktop gaming PCs obviously consume a lot of power, and their relative power efficiency is lower when compared to that of small form factor systems, which is why Dell can no longer ship some of its Alienware gaming desktops to California, Colorado, and some other states. Dell's high-performance Aurora R10 and Aurora R12, both Intel and AMD-based desktops, cannot be shipped to the states of California, Colorado, Hawaii, Oregon, Vermont, or Washington due to power consumption regulations adopted by those states. A notice over the company's website reads, "The reason why Dell cannot ship such systems to California is because the California Energy Commission adopted the tighter appliance energy principles that outline a compulsory energy efficiency standard for PCs starting July 1. The new standards are largely based on Energy Star computer program and defined power consumption of PCs, all kinds of PCs, including thin clients and handheld devices in non-active states, short idle, long idle, sleep, and off, as well as their maximum power consumption per year. All types of power consumptions are tied to the PC's expandability score. Its concept was described by Energy Star several years ago that takes into account things like high-performance graphics cards, system memory bandwidth, high-speed external ports, and other things. Starting from July 1 of this year, high-end desktops can consume no more than 75 kilowatt hours per year. But if it is equipped with a discrete graphics card or some other adder, its maximum power consumption can be increased based on bandwidth of graphics card's onboard memory. The problem is that even with the adders included, Dell's Alienware gaming systems will not comply with the new requirements. Dell's Alienware is obviously not the only PC maker in the United States, but a quick check of other makers of high-performance gaming systems and workstations reveals that they do not have similar alerts for their customers in California and other states. It is unclear whether their systems comply with the tighter requirements or they are awaiting instructions to update their sites. Meanwhile, it is clear that over time, the new regulations will affect all high-performance machines. It should be noted that the new standards do not cover do-it-yourself PCs, so if you're like me, an enthusiast with enough time, well, when I find time, and putting in some effort and experience, can build whatever PCs I like. Furthermore, it is logical to expect PC makers to offer systems without certain components, which will be installed by the end user later on after purchase, in a bid to comply with tighter regulations, but still offer products to their customers. Before I was able to fully digest the idea of California banning high-end PCs, California seemed to walk it back a little by offering a clarification. This all started when Alienware put notices on its website of certain model desktop PCs that cannot be sold in California, Colorado, Washington, Oregon, Hawaii, and Vermont due to power consumption regulations adopted by those states. Any orders placed that are bound for those states will be canceled. This narrative had its genesis in California due to the regulations that had been passed in 2016. The California Energy Commission reports and meeting minutes In it, on the face of it, it did sound like California's strict power regulations would end most desktop PC sales in California on July the 1st. Power regulators were mostly looking for ways to rein in the power use of PCs in idle mode as a way to manage energy use during the workday. Regulators were primarily targeting the typical compact PC or all-in-one that you see sitting in the banks, hospitals, and businesses, not gaming PCs. In standard bureaucratic style, though, it's neither easy nor clear-cut to know which PCs are being targeted. This is truly an example of from the sublime to the ridiculous. If California and other states go through with this ill-conceived regulation, which I think they might, developers will be banned from using higher performance equipment for application development. For those who are doing Bitcoin mining, it's time to consider relocating to a more friendly developing location. And if you're a gamer, well, I guess you have to put together your own machine. Apple confirms constraint on the supply of iPhone 13. Apple's chief financial officer, Luca Maestri, warned that supply of its products will be badly affected moving forward. Moreover, Maestri said it is iPhones and iPads which will suffer most. They expect supply constraints during the September quarter to be greater than what we experienced during the June quarter. The constraints will primarily impact iPhone and iPad. For context, September is the month Apple is widely expected to launch the new iPhone 13 range as well as a redesign of the iPad mini. Development has been ahead of schedule, with Apple ordering over 100 million next-generation A15 chips in expectation of record-breaking demand. Unfortunately, however, Maestro warning highlights the difference between ordering and being able to attain the necessary chips to meet demand. And for a company of Apple's unparalleled supply chain expertise, this is something of a shock. While the global chip shortage has impacted most companies, Apple has coped far better than most and has been primarily graphics card, games console, and car makers, which have been hit the worst, as anyone trying to buy an Xbox Series X or PlayStation 5 will attest to. More positively, Apple did say it still expected strong double-digit growth for the September quarter. But anyone hoping to add to the company's bottom line by buying a new iPhone 13 looks set for a disappointment. As gamers have found in the console space, limited supply attracts professional scalpers, which only exacerbates the problem and drives prices through the roof. For those who are planning to upgrade to the iPhone 13 because they have many new features in the lineup, which includes smaller notch, supersized rear cameras with extreme image stabilization, a cutting-edge A15 chipset, next-generation 5G, and for the Pro models, 120Hz ProMotion displays. Consequently, the decision whether to try and upgrade this year is likely to prove tougher than normal, especially with 2022 increasingly looks like an iPhone SE year. Apple is expected to release a new iPhone SE in 2022, likely as a direct follow-up to the current SE model from 2020. What has happened to the PC market for the second quarter of this year? The latest data from Canalys shows that the worldwide PC market, including tablets, posted yet another quarter of annual growth, with shipments up to 10% to 121.7 million units for the second quarter. Chromebooks continue to outperform the rest of the industry product categories, posting 75% annual growth and a shipment volume of 11.9 million units. Tablet shipments growth has begun to stabilize with an increase in the second quarter of 4% to 39.1 million units. Tablets and Chromebooks combined account for 42% of all PC sales in the second quarter. Canalys reported that the success of Chromebooks is proving to be remarkably resilient, stating that their growth streak has extended well beyond the height of the pandemic as they have cemented a healthy position across all end-user segments in the industry, even as key markets like North America and Western Europe have seen schools begin to open up. Shipments remain elevated as governments and education ecosystems plan for a long-term integration of Chromebooks within digital learning processes. With Chrome's hold over the education space relatively secure, Google is set to bet big on the commercial segment this year. They expect to see a strong focus on attracting small businesses with updated services, such as the new individual subscription tier for Google Workspace and promotions on cloud-ready licenses to repurpose old PCs for deployment alongside existing Chromebook fleets. However, with Apple eyeing to expand its M1 success into the commercial space and Microsoft launching Windows 11 later this year, the PC operating system race is set to be the most hotly contested it has been in a long time. In the tablet space, the second quarter brought mixed fortunes in terms of growth, but all vendors continue to enjoy elevated shipment levels compared to pre-pandemic times. Apple maintained its leadership position in the rankings with 14.2 million iPads shipped for relatively flat performance. Samsung was a big winner in terms of the market share growth as it increased shipments 13.8% to post 8 million tablet units shipped. Lenovo enjoyed the highest growth out of the top five at 78%, shipping 4.7 million units. Amazon and Huawei made up the remainder of the leaders. The tablet market has truly put to rest all predictions of a slow demise. We have now seen a fifth consecutive quarter of year-on-year growth in the PC industry and has many reasons to be optimistic for the future, even as consumer demand for tablets undergoes an inevitable slowdown in the coming quarters. There are exciting developments to be seen in commercial deployments. Canalys expects to see stronger integration between the tablet and PC, allowing for smoother workflow transitions between multiple platform devices, which is especially attractive to those operating on the hybrid and on-the-go work styles. This will certainly be the case for iPads and Macs, but the introduction of Windows 11 on cloud and its usage on devices that can run Android bodes well for tablet vendors, users, and developers beyond the Apple ecosystem. To recap, the total PC market, which includes desktops, notebooks, and tablets, Lenovo is a leading vendor with 19.7% of market share, followed second by Apple, 18.1% market share, and just trailing Lenovo by less than 2%. HP is third with 15.8% market share, Dell has 10.7% market share, and Samsung has 8% market share. When they say that the PC business is dead, don't believe it. When you look at the tablet, if you just add a keyboard to it physically, it is a PC. Many people may argue that it's not, but if you don't have a physical keyboard, you have a virtual keyboard. And how's that different from the Microsoft Surface PC, where if you detach the keyboard, you have a virtual keyboard? Isn't that a tablet? To me, a computer is when you have an operating system on it and you can browse the internet on it, and almost all of them have office functions on it. It is a personal computer. Intel chief warns of two-year chip shortage. Intel Corporation Chief Executive Officer Pat Gelsinger sees the global semiconductor shortage potentially stretching into 2023, adding a leading industry voice to the growing view that the chip supply disruptions hitting companies and consumers won't wane soon. Intel CEO Pat Gelsinger predicts the shortage will get worse in the second half of this year, and it will be a year or two before supplies return to normal. The disruption caused by huge demand for devices, the pandemic, and poor relations between the United States and China has created a very large gulf, he says. He stressed the need to normalize relationships with China. Pat Gelsinger said that the building of new factories will be crucial, but it will take time. He says Intel would announce new semiconductor factories in the United States and Europe by the end of the year, but warns it's going to be a year or 2 years until we get back to some reasonable supply-demand balance. It comes against a backdrop of pretty poor relations between the United States and China, and the whole industry being caught up in that conflict. Intel has 25% of its revenues tied up in China, which Pat Gelsinger says has an insatiable thirst for technology that helps them digitize the economy. He said he hoped that Intel could be as influential as possible in bringing back good relations between the United States and China. We need to keep doing business in China. If we don't, they're forced to build indigenous alternatives. Intel is making a new push into the foundry business, which will involve manufacturing custom computer chips for tech companies and Western governments. Intel's first major customers will be Qualcomm and Amazon. Qualcomm, which dominates chips for mobile phones, will use what Intel is calling its 20A chip-making process, which will use new transistor technology to help reduce how much power the chip consumes. Amazon, which is increasingly making its own data center chips for its Amazon Web Services, is not yet using Intel's chip-making technology, but will use Intel's packaging technology. The process of assembling chips and chiplets, or tiles, often stacking them up in so-called 3D formation. Intel excels in this packaging technology. Intel Corporation said its factories will start building Qualcomm chips and laid out a roadmap to expand its new foundry business to catch rivals such as Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company and Samsung Electronics Limited by 2025. Amazon.com Inc. will be another new customer for the foundry chip business, said Intel, which for decades held the lead in technology for manufacturing the smallest, fastest computing chips. But Intel has lost that lead to Taiwan Semiconductor and Samsung, whose manufacturing services have helped Intel's rivals, Advanced Micro Devices and NVIDIA Corporation, produce chips that outperform Intel's. AMD and NVIDIA design chips which then are made by the rival chip manufacturers called foundries. Intel said it expects to regain its lead by 2025 and describe 5 sets of chip-making technologies it will roll out over the next 4 years. Pat Gelsinger acknowledged that the firm had lost ground to rivals such as Taiwan Semiconductor and Samsung. We did stumble. We did fall behind to some degree. But we've laid out now a clear path to parity with the industry. An analyst with real-world technologies says Intel really does have people who spend all their time looking at how to deploy new materials and technology to juice their performance. Well, let's hope Intel gets back on track and build those chip foundries at warp speed. When will the global chip shortage end? Manufacturing is making a comeback in most industries after languishing during the pandemic, and supplies of chips used to operate most devices are in short supply. The shortage is being felt acutely in the automotive industry and will for as long as 2 years. One of the issues is that there isn't the return on investment to build foundries to satisfy the demand by the automakers. Many are also not investing in what we call legacy technology. The semiconductor shortage will impact almost everything. In the digital age, semiconductor chips have made their way into a host of everyday items. Over the last year, COVID-19 has highlighted how interwoven are global supply chains and myriad chip-centric industries with backlog inventories and empty store shelves. While the automotive slowdowns and limited laptop supplies have made plenty of headlines in the last year, the silicon scarcity impacts consumer electronics, home appliances, medical devices, and even toys are suffering from chip availability. There are production disruptions on smaller quantities. If Apple wants 100 million chips, But a little company wants 5,000. Guess who wins? Apple, of course. In terms of company size, the largest organizations are seeing the smallest impact, while the small businesses are being hit the hardest. In the interim, companies are left to vie for a slice of the silicon pie, leading to cross-industry competition for chips. For example, NVIDIA designed a dedicated chip for crypto mining to serve as a detriment to miners buying up its gaming GPUs. The automotive industry has made plenty of headlines as shortages lead to production bottlenecks. Earlier this year, Ford announced that it was decreasing F-150 production due to chip constraints. The automotive industry is getting intense media attention right now, so chip makers will step up to fix that backlog soon. That will come at an expense of other products. If Ford, Honda, and Daimler are getting chips, someone else is not. That will exacerbate other shortages that would be just as big, but perhaps less visible. These chip-related market disruptions have hamstrung myriad industries for months, and shortages could continue well into the holiday shopping season later this year. Chip-related disruptions in the toy industry could end up being the one big story of the holiday. Another problem is poor planning. During the second quarter of 2020, automotive OEMs shut down, as did most of the world. As they did that, they canceled orders from a lot of supply chain. So a lot of disgruntled suppliers found other markets that were still doing well despite the pandemic. In the market for a new car, smartphones or washing machines this year, a global shortage of computer chips could mean you have to wait a while and pay more. A growing number of manufacturers around the world are having trouble securing supplies of semiconductors, delaying the production and delivery of goods and threatening to push up the prices paid by consumers. Several factors are driving the crunch, which was initially concentrated in the auto industry. The first is the coronavirus pandemic, which plunged the global economy into recession last year, upending supply chains and changing consumer shopping patterns. Car makers cut back orders for chips, while tech companies, whose products were boosted by lockdown living, snapped up as many as they could. Other shocks, such as U.S. government sanctions on Chinese technology companies and extreme weather, have also contributed to the shortage of supply. The computer chips in highest demand are not particularly sophisticated or expensive, but they're indispensable components used in everything from kitchen appliance to washing machines and electronic gadgets. The shortage is going from bad to worse, spreading from cars to consumer electronics. With the bulk of chip production concentrated in a handful of suppliers, analysts warn that the crunch is likely to last through into 2022. These include the Big Eight cloud infrastructure providers, which saw demand skyrocket when people began working from home and children were attending school remotely, causing a massive spike in PCs, tablets, and consumer electronics. And then we have trade sanctions and phone rollouts added to the global chip shortage. The Gartner Group said that they expect worldwide semiconductor shortage to last into the second quarter of 2022. Add to this the rollout of 5G smartphone and the trade sanctions the United States placed on China before the pandemic. This meant Huawei, one of the largest 5G smartphone makers in China, couldn't buy chips after a certain time. They knew they couldn't procure chips for their products, so they placed big orders. Likewise, Apple and other smartphone makers also placed large chip orders, which kept the foundries extremely busy. Then you had the sudden increase in demand because of COVID-19. The pandemic played a big role in the chip shortage. Demand for cloud computing services from providers like Amazon with AWS, Microsoft Azure, and Alibaba continues to skyrocket. They buy lots of semiconductors. Mobile phone sales remain hot. Makers like Apple, Samsung, Huawei buy lots of chips. PCs are hot. Piled on top of that is the shortage of GPUs and other chips grabbed up by cryptocurrency gluttons. Demand is hotter than ever, and it only gets hotter. The global shortage is cutting a wide swath beyond mobile devices.
If it had a plug or a battery, it's probably full of chips. The wireless community, industrial, aerospace, military, anyone or everyone whose product requires semiconductor chips is facing a shortage. A few isolated events, including an earthquake and semiconductor fabrication plant fire in Japan and a winter storm in Texas in March, which shut down some fabs this year, have also contributed to the problem. Automotive, industrial sectors, suffering most due to global chip shortage. The automotive and industrial market segments, which are still using legacy node technology not only at the back of the line and don't get priority for chip orders like smartphones, PC or cloud infrastructure providers, would get, well, it'll take long for them to recover. These industries have inefficient supply chains, and even if they could get chips to move upstream, it could take months for them to reach the end product. They may get the chips by the third quarter of this year, and they'll start finally seeing production, but it will not be until the first half of next year, potentially, that you'll see cars with chips that they were asking for run intelligent smart systems, ABS brakes, or powertrain. When you're shocked by the pandemic, it's hard to operate without business continuity planning. Besides the fact that they use legacy technologies, these industries are also low priority because when they shut down last year, they forced the semiconductor to take on the risk of uncertainty. So a lot of suppliers move to other products, and they'll move to the automotive industry when they're ready. In contrast, gaming companies have experienced a tightness in supply because they are more on the leading edge side and forecasted products better. A lot of this has to do with the business decisions made. Automotive industry operates in just-in-time environment. When you're shocked by the pandemic, it's hard to operate without business continuity planning. The Japanese semiconductor and automotive companies aren't crying shock because they know what to expect from past tsunamis and earthquakes and are able to better anticipate their supply needs. There is no short-term solution. If supply is constrained, you cannot increase it in a short time frame. We're looking at the second quarter of next year before lead times improve. In the meantime, prices will go up, and you have to make do with what you now have. And if you don't have it, you have to find some other alternative. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with the IT Pro Series. Important information, technology experience factors in hiring.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we get together and we talk about IT in the workplace, but also at times how we fit into the workplace through IT. And this week I want to talk about the hiring decision. And this hiring decision has to do with two sides, the employer side and the employee side. I'm going to address it from the employer side, and I hope you can interpret from the IT, from the employee side, how IT is going to work into your resume, how you're going to find a new job, and how you're going to move forward with this. So, on the employer side, I want to talk about this, and I want you to understand that everybody should know Microsoft Office. They should know Windows. They should know Acrobat. If you're in a Mac environment, of course, there's a little bit of different world there, but not much. What I want you to look for, rather than looking for, do they know Windows? Do they know Office? Do they know this, that, whatever? I want you to actually look for a diversity of software experience. I want you to look for many different packages that they've worked with. Let's say they've worked at five different companies, and those five different companies have had XYZ software, and they all ran XYZ software. Well, that's not so important. But if they had ABC software and DEF software and XYZ software and QRX software, whatever it is, if they've dealt with five different packages over the course of five different employers over the course of the last 12 years, 15 years, that's going to be a lot better than somebody who's worked at five different places and the only thing that changed was the different places. The software was always the same. Why is this? And that's because if they can pick up multiple software packages, they're going to pick up the nuanced software packages, the different versions, maybe of even the same software packages that you're running, but they're going to pick up different things than somebody who's always been doing the same thing over and over again. You want to ask how they learned those different packages. You want to ask how comfortable they are with those different packages, even if you're not using them. It's those vertical market software packages. It's your ERP software. It's the custom software that somebody's written for your company, 5 years ago. And it was custom written, so nobody's ever going to have experience with this except people who are trained on it. So you want to make sure that these people are teachable. You want to look for somebody who's been dealing with technology for a number of years. And I'm not talking, okay, they know how to print. I'm talking about just overall technology skills. If they've been working on computers for 25 years, even if they've just been doing kind of the basics all the way along for 25 years, they're going to be mostly self-sufficient, especially the longer they've been in various jobs. If you're looking at somebody and they've been in the marketplace, they just got out of college and they've got a year or two of experience in the workplace, well, there's going to be some struggles there if you've got older software or if you've got different setups that have been in place for a long time. Now, let's move into the IT workers. You want to look for people who have broad experience. Yeah, we can talk about all of this specialized experience, and I will tell you that if you put out a request for somebody who has 10 different specialties, you're either going to find out that person is lying, or they've got really just a scant amount of information in each of those specialties, and they're not going to be an expert in any of them to the level you want. You want to highlight the three big most important items that need to be on their resume. They need to be experienced in your ERP software. They need to be experienced in one of the related ERP softwares. They need to be experienced in your particular form of networking or whatever it is. But I also want to see those people's skills. I want to see communication qualities over nerd qualities. I want to see that they understand the users and their complaints. Lastly, experience with a business is most important. The statistical analysis, the driving the data results in a direction that shares success and failures that can be both used, both the successes and failures can be used to drive business excellence. I want to see on anybody's resume, I want to see hard numbers. We saved this much time. We increased revenue by this. We decreased expenditures by this. We did this business improvement or that business improvement. See, that reflects on what the business wants and needs. Yeah, you can have a network technician over there, and he's a network tech, and he's the greatest network tech in the world. But if he does not understand that you can't take a server down in the middle of the day when there's 100 people trying to access that server, if he doesn't understand that, you're never going to be able to explain it to him. You'll never get the business excellence out of him that you really want. So as an employee, I hope you understand that, yes, you need to be learning those soft skills. You need to be learning that the users are most important. You need to understand that the business, if the business makes money, you make money. If the business fails, you fail. And nothing is worse than having a resume full of failed businesses where you were responsible. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Is the desktop PC market dead? Any evaluation of the state of the desktop PC market needs to look at the latest sales figures, and the market is booming right now. This year and last have seen a big uptake in overall PC sales.
And while a lot of buyers have been picking up new laptops, desktop computers have been gathering momentum as well. In the most recent figures reported from IDC, in the second quarter of this year, were increased demand for PCs, and when combined with shortages that greatly impacted the supply of notebooks, this led to desktop growth outpacing that of notebooks during the quarter. This current desktop PC surge is in part due to component shortages interfering with laptop supplies. The other glaring obvious factor is many more people are working from home, requiring new devices or upgrades to do so. While there's impressive growth currently, there are unprecedented reasons for it, with more people likely to continue working from home in the future or shifting to a model of hybrid working, which means remaining remote working to some extent, this demand is not likely to go away. The pandemic has fueled sales. As time has progressed, PCs have made considerable progress on the life expectancy of the hardware, and as hardware components, primarily processors, have become more powerful over the years, they rather outpace software and games, meaning that as time marches on, any given chip is good and can run most things just fine for an increasingly longer duration. This, in turn, means people don't need to upgrade their PC as often, which obviously has a dampening factor on sales. There are a number of good reasons why desktop PCs have been and remain a wanted computing commodity. In any debate about the staying power of the PC, one of the central thrusts of an argument that these desktop beasts won't be dying off anytime soon will inevitably be the necessity for these kinds of machines to handle certain heavyweight tasks. If you're into, say, video editing or 3D rendering, the PC offers unrivaled performance that you just can't get from a laptop or any other portable device. This is simply a matter of size and form factor, temperatures and cooling. There is no way a giant top-tier graphics card can fit into a notebook, or more to the point, for multiple powerful and power-hungry components to be kept cool without a big airy case, and some seriously sizable fans to go with it. Power users looking to tackle heavyweight computing tasks and run multiple demanding apps will always need the beefiest PC going, and that's a desktop, possibly with a multiple monitor set up to boot. Much the same is true for gamers. Sure, you can get some impressively powerful gaming laptops these days, but if you want the speediest rig, offering the fastest frame rates, not to mention a big 4K or ultra-wide screen, it's the same deal with the components, cooling and space offered by the old PC case. You'll need that for enthusiast-level overclocking, too. Another compelling consideration is that desktop PCs simply offer much more bang for the buck. With a laptop, you're paying for the privilege of the manufacturer packing smaller components into that slim chassis. Desktop PCs are just a straight-up better value proposition, and you can see this by looking at the spec of any laptop and getting the same components in a desktop, then compare the prices, although exorbitant cutting-edge desktop GPU prices are making any gap closer than it normally is. But that situation shouldn't last with any luck. Of course, with a desktop PC, you also get the flexibility to be able to choose exactly which components you want, and not just pick from a short list of a few options, if any exist. And if you're buying standalone pieces of hardware to build your own PC, hey, that works out even cheaper. Not something you can do with a notebook, obviously. Customization options are endless with a desktop machine. Not only that, but the versatility of the desktop is an obvious plus point when it comes to upgrading. If your graphics card starts to feel behind the times playing the latest games, well, what you do is you simply swap it out for a new model. That can give your PC a whole new lease on life for several years. Similarly, if a component goes wrong in a desktop computer, it's, generally speaking, relatively easy to swap it out for a replacement part. With laptops, when it comes to upgrades or repairs, you're very often left in the lurch. Many portables don't offer any realistic way to perform either of these feats, at least not yourself, with components all being soldered directly onto the motherboard.
Some notebooks allow for upgrading the system RAM or storage, but that's about as good as it gets. Otherwise, in the case of faults, you're looking at an expensive third-party repair or buying an entirely new device. The latter can sometimes make more financial sense than the former, sadly speaking. Are desktop PCs dead? Well, for all the above reasons, and looking at the current climate of PC sales, or even pre-pandemic shipment levels, the answer seems pretty clearly to be no. Desktops aren't dead, dying, or even sickly for that matter. As we move forward into the future, it's likely be the case that the desktop PC in terms of sales may dwindle, but they won't die. The desktop PC is just too important for those who really need a seriously powerful machine to meet their needs. Content creators, professionals whose computing time directly translates to money, and gamers who need the kind of power on tap to have a crack at 4K, all bells and whistles, or high refresh rate gaming. And not to mention people who want to build their own rigs and have full control over the spec of their PC and the potential to upgrade or repair it going forward. In short, the ability to get the most for the money. In the longer term future, the situation around desktops could eventually change, most likely due to a continual shift to a cloud-based PC or PC as a service model, where users may be able to tap into all the power they need remotely and stream their desktop, like game streaming, and speaking of which, Shadow already offers a complete cloud PC solution. There could be other issues around that transition, though, in terms of control, privacy, and security, not to mention shifting the demands to your net connection and the internet infrastructure required to make all this work widely and slickly. For now, though, and certainly for the foreseeable future, the desktop PC remains in good health. It's not going anywhere anytime soon. And in case you want to know, yes, I still have desktops at home. PCI Express 4.0 is a fourth generation of the peripheral component Internet Express, which we normally are more familiar with PCIe, which is an interface standard that connects high-end components to your PC. It is used for connecting add-in cards and M.2 drives, which we are more familiar with the term solid-state drives, as well as interconnecting various chips inside a PC. Compared to its predecessor, PCI Express 3.0, PCI Express 4.0 essentially doubles the overall throughput. The PCI Special Interest Group had released this spec back in 2017, and compared to PCI Express 3.0, the data transfer rate doubles from 8 gigatransfers per second to 16 gigatransfers per second, and allows a maximum net data rate of around 2 gigabytes per lane. The PCI Express 4.0 has up to 16 lanes, which achieves almost 32 gigabytes of throughput per second. In the case of an M.2 solid-state drive, which supports up to 4 lanes, that is a maximum of 8 gigabytes per second. The typical solid-state drive is either 3 bits per cell or 4 bits per cell, and that translates to a maximum transfer rate on the solid-state drive of 4 gigabytes per second for the 3-bit per cell and 2 gigabytes per second for QLC, which is the quad-level cell, for 4 bits per cell. Even faster solid-state drives based on PCI Express 5.0 are expected to arrive next year. PCI Express 5.0 will double the throughput of PCI Express 4.0. The transfer rate of PCI Express 5.0 is up to 32 giga transfer per second versus the 16 giga transfer per second supported by PCI 4.0. With 64 gigabytes per second of unidirectional transfer bandwidth, the PCI Express 5.0 provides data throughput at 128 gigabytes of bidirectional traffic. As more platforms supporting PCI Express 5.0 is made available, so will speedier solid-state drives. It didn't take very long for storage makers to offer solid-state drives that nearly saturate the PCI Express 4.0 bus when plugged into a 4-slot, as all consumer non-volatile memory drives do. Truly faster solid-state drives will arrive with the adoption of PCI Express 5.0. As such, expect to see PCI Express 5.0 solid-state drives made available in 2022. More specifically, analysts at TrendForce anticipate next-gen SSDs to hit the ground running in the second and third quarter of next year. TrendForce is looking at things from the data center angle and is basing its prediction on the availability of new interfaces for servers. But as is typically the case, consumer products shouldn't be far behind. Intel and AMD are expected to kick off mass production of EagleStream and Genoa CPUs, respectively, in the first half of next year. In addition to being compatible with PCI Express G5, these server processors will support the Computer Express Link interface. TrendForce investigations indicate that NAND flash suppliers have been fast-tracking their production of PCI Express G5 solid-state drives in response to the upcoming mass production of EagleStream. As such, TrendForce adds these solid-state drives are likely to see market release, sometime in the second or third quarter of next year. The research firm doesn't discuss what this means for consumer solid-state drives, but don't be surprised if mainstream PCI Express 5.0 solid-state drives arrive around the same time, or possibly even earlier. Why? Intel is getting ready to release its first batch of Alder Lake CPUs this year, and possibly in late October and November, and we already know that Alder Lake will support PCI Express 5.0 as well as DDR5 memory.
Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The Westchester PC User Group meets Thursday, August the 5th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, August the 6th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Jitsi, and their website is acgnj.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, August the 12th at 7 p.m. It's an online virtual meeting via Zoom. The website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, August the 13th at 7 p.m. It's an online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is limac.org. Brookdale Computer Users Group, Thursday, August the 26th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is bcug.com. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.